Are you a nonprofit professional who's feeling overwhelmed and burnt out? Well, welcome to the Lead with Heart podcast. I am your host, Haley Cooper. On this podcast, we will share stories of leadership, courage, and empathy that'll help you learn to take care of yourself, your staff, organization, and community. You will hear from nonprofit leaders who have been in your shoes and have learned best practices to raise more revenue and make a greater impact. Let's thrive together.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Lead with Heart podcast. This is your host, Haley Cooper. And today I am so honored to have Nisha Anand of Dream.org. She's the CEO. And I was so excited when she reached out to be on this podcast and I did a little bit more research and I was like, oh, she is amazing. So we're going to just dive right into this conversation and I'm going to introduce you to her and then she's going to talk a little bit more about her background. Let's get right into it. Nisha is an Indian American activist, mom of two teenagers, and a boundary busting national leader for social and racial justice. Once a grassroots activist arrested in Burma for pro-democracy demonstrations, Nisha is known today as a leader in cultivating unlikely and unconventional partnerships to create change. As Dream.org CEO, Nisha guides a team of storytellers, organizers, and policy experts working on some of the society's toughest problems to create a better future for all. Well, welcome, Nisha.
Thanks. Thank you for having me.
Well, let's just get right into it. Like I said, so I'd love to know a little bit more. There's so much in this bio that we can unpack. How did you start out as a grassroots activist? Was there something in your childhood that like led you to this and then really getting to where you are today?
Sure. It is really funny when I hear a bio back or when any one of us recites our own bio, it doesn't always feel remarkable. And then someone else has to look at it and say, wow, that was your life. And a lot of that is why I am who I am. I think we're fascinating people, each and every one of us that have these giant histories for a multitude of so many different things and parts that make us who we are and how we ended up being the way we're being. And when you put it on paper, it's everybody is remarkable. I'm sometimes accused of being a little bit of a toxic positivity person, but I also really mean it. We are fascinating human beings. And so I love getting to know folks in this way. A little bit about me then and how I got to be all of those different things. I think that for me, the earliest I can date it back is growing up in the South. I grew up in the 80s in Atlanta, Georgia, and it was very much a black and white town. And I am neither. I'm this something in between. And my parents are immigrants. And I really felt like for them, I played the role of being the bridge between the old world and the new. Being born and raised in America, I am very American. It's a huge piece of who I am. But having Indian immigrant parents, there is always this way of being that is very culturally different than all of the Americans I grew up with. And so that identity, Indian American, no one said that growing up. It was like, what are you? That's how I was growing up. And so I think that from an early age, I had to decide, who am I? I had to have an answer to that question. And what I discovered was that was my superpower. I am able to translate between all of those different worlds. Because I never fit in anywhere, I actually found a way into fitting in everywhere and understanding there's a little piece of me that does relate to all different parts and different people and playing that role, often translating really funny things between my parents and America. It allows me to do that now in my life and where I'm at. And I find myself doing that every day in the work that I do at Dream.org. We often find ourselves in these rooms trying to explain why we're trying to pass a big piece of legislation with a progressive agenda and why we're doing it with Republican partners. And it's because I can understand where different folks are coming from. So I think that's the beginnings of my origin story. I have to be playing that role when I was a kid.
Wow. Thank you so much for sharing. And you're just so strong and courageous. And I'm sure as a mom now, you're helping navigate your teenagers through that as well, understanding where you came from and passing that on to the next generation is so amazing. And I would love to know, you said you were once a grassroots activist arrested in Burma. So from Atlanta, Georgia, How did you end up in Burma being arrested for pro-democracy demonstrations?
Yes, that is also a great question. I was growing up in Atlanta, I was a little bit of a rebellious spirit. I think that because I had to break the mold of the expectations of what I should be, very much in my culture, I would have been the height of success if I had just been pretty and married well and married in my class or married someone rich. That would have been enough, being a good wife and a good mom. That was what was aspirational. I wanted something different, and I knew that from a young age. And so I guess, and I didn't think about it quite as thoughtfully as I think about it now, but I think knowing that wasn't going to be my pathway, I broke the mold and I broke it really hard. And so I became this really radical activist. Any single cause that I felt there was an underdog, someone who was left out or left behind, I wanted to jump on that cause. I've always just been that person who wants to fight for justice and fight for inclusion and really make sure no one else feels that locked out of the world like I did growing up. So yeah, I was a young activist. I was arrested about a dozen times for different causes. I got really into studying nonviolence and the history of nonviolence and civil disobedience. And I was just willing to be arrested. That's how I found myself on the street sometimes. I found myself in the center ring of the Ringling Brothers circus protesting animal abuse, locked at the neck. I found myself in a lot of different situations. And so in college, one of the really active groups on campus was the Free Burma Coalition. And at that time in the 90s, Myanmar had been a military to Burma and Myanmar. I use it interchangeably because at different times in history, they have meant different things. But Myanmar had been a military dictatorship since its independence. It flirted with the idea of democracy several times. And every time a Democratic Party won, the military junta would take over, repress it, murder, massacre. It's a military dictatorship. There's no other way to describe it. It's every horrific thing you can imagine. But being an extreme isolationist country run by a ruler who rules based on astrology more than anything else, like it's a pretty stark, horrible place, yet has this heart for democracy. So it was a very active group on my campus, and they were doing a trip to Thailand one summer to learn about the resistance movement. The refugees go up and down the border between Thai and Burma and learn about what was happening there. So I signed up for the trip. One of the people we met who was organizing against the human rights abuses in Myanmar, she wanted to organize a protest. She had 18 international activists from around the world. So there was us from the US, Thailand, Indonesia, Australia, a few other places, to go into Burma on the 10-year anniversary of the 8/8/88 uprising. So August 8th, 1988, students rose up to protest the recent results of the election that the military cracked down on, and about 10,000 students were murdered at that time. Well, I found myself in Thailand 10 years to the date later, and she was organizing this protest. And the kid that I was, I said, sign me up. And so I went in with 18 international activists. We handed out these leaflets, which we smuggled in our shoes and our suitcases, cutting out the lining. And they were about the size of a business card. And all they said was, we are your friends from around the world. We support your hopes for human rights and democracy. That's all it said. But that is highly illegal in Myanmar, then most likely now as well. And handing that out, we knew, was an offense punishable by death, but we did it. And we were expected home on a plane right after we handed those out. And none of us made it back. We were all arrested before we reached the airport. I guess some people reached the airport and then were arrested, but none of us got on that plane back to Thailand. And it became an international news story. I was held inside Burma for about a week. We were then rushed off to a sham trial at the end of the week where we were sentenced to 5 years hard labor. And obviously that's a really scary moment, but I honestly can't tell you. I knew I couldn't show fear. How a military regime takes over is fear. But within maybe 4 hours, we were told that the next day we'd be deported. And so we were deported the next day. We didn't serve the 5 years. That's part of the story. How I ended up there was just being willing to do whatever it took for causes I felt were unjust. I learned a lot of lessons. I think one of the biggest lessons I learned there, which set me on this path, was that the person who came to Thailand to help get us out of prison from the US government was a Republican congressman, Republican Chris Smith from New Jersey, and he still serves in Congress. And I thought, being the young activist I was, that I was going to share a plane ride home with Representative Smith and tell him all the ways in which he's wrong and all of these things that he should do differently because I knew better. And instead, we shared a plane ride and talked about all of the areas we agree. He was the head of the Human Rights Commission, so he had a lot of interest in human rights abuses that I shared. And I learned a lot in that moment about power and what I thought power meant. The idea that I had as a young activist that I was always fighting the power and against these people, whoever these people were, to find out I had a lot in common with those folks was a really important lesson for me back in 1998.
Hey there, podcast family. If you're like me and deeply committed to improving your leadership skills and fostering better connections with your team, I've got something truly amazing to share with you. I'm proud to introduce the EMC Masterclass, something I talk about often as a certified trainer. It's an incredible program developed by the renowned Dr. Lola Gershfeld, an organizational psychologist and corporate emotional connection expert. You might remember her from a podcast episode where she shared invaluable insights into the world of emotional connection. Dr. Gershfeld's EMC Leaders courses are designed for anyone working with people. Whether you're a manager, supervisor, team leader, educator, coach, mentor, or a team member, this program is truly for everyone looking to enhance their communication and collaboration skills to raise more revenue for their mission. Now, let me tell you why the EMC Masterclass is a game changer. Dr. Gershfeld's groundbreaking emotional connection process has been integrated into top universities' curriculum and recognized by international organizations like ICF, HRCI, and SHRM. Humans are wired to seek emotional safety, and when we feel safe, we're more likely to take risks, share innovative ideas, and collaborate effectively. The EMC process is the catalyst for creating that emotional safety within your team. The virtual EMC Masterclass consists of 8 modules with 4 hours of expertly recorded material, 13 quizzes to reinforce your learning, and a workbook filled with activities for offline practice and something I still refer to daily. Ready to become an emotional connection master? Dr. Gershfeld is offering an exclusive deal for our podcast listeners. Use the code LEADWITHHEART to enjoy a generous 10% discount on the EMC Masterclass. Head over to emcleaders.com and enroll in the EMC Masterclass today.
Wow. Thank you so much for sharing your story and just the vulnerability of the lessons that you've learned and just through the scary moments and the fear. I can only imagine what that felt like being arrested in a foreign country. I can't even imagine. But I love that you said out of that, the lesson learned was you were going to tell this guy all the things that he's doing wrong, but you got to share what was in you had in common. And I think in this day and age of technology and social media, obviously social media didn't exist back in 1988 or 1998. And I think that is how our culture is right now, is so quick to dismiss people, so quick to prove our point. If you don't agree with me, you're canceled. I'm not going to interact with you. And I know that you're raising up 2 teenagers who are experiencing this. So I would love to know your advice on like, how to navigate conversations when you disagree with someone to make sure that everyone feels seen and heard and still have meaningful conversations, because I think that's so hard to come by these days.
It really is. I'm raising my kids in Berkeley, California. So they have very little exposure to very different ideas. It's a little bit scary. And so what they've been raised with in Berkeley is very much your left, progressive, farther left, radical, really left. That's the degrees of what they've been raised with. So there is a lot of you have to say the right thing in the right way to be accepted. And if you deviate even a little from that, you're the devil, right? That really is how things are conveyed for raising my kids. And I'm about to send in 5 days, I'm flying across country with my son to put him in college in New York. I know. Wow. I'm like a mess of emotions right now.
I'm surprised you're here.
I'm like such a mess of emotions. Yeah, I'm going to miss that guy so much. But he's really looking forward to it. He's always been contrarian. He's always wanted to say, and that's a little bit like me, right? There's some of me in that where everyone says I should think this way. I want to say something else. I want to give you a different idea. And I'm really looking forward to him being able to explore it in college, where you are supposed to have this exposure to the biggest ideas in the world. And they should be very different than yours. Disagreement. I think when you said what I tell people, disagreement's important. It's beautiful. Like I said, we're very different people, all of us. There are multitudes of us around. It's okay to disagree. We have to remember that. Disagreement, debate, discussion, fiercely held beliefs that are so different, that can be beautiful. It has been in the past. In fact, that was what the idea of the democracy in America was founded on, was that we want to protect all the different. It shouldn't be this way in which a minority opinion can rule, right? There is this beautiful pluralism that's supposed to exist in this country that is becoming harder and harder to grasp right now. And so I definitely want to tell people to debate and discuss. You have to. You cannot just close your ears to ideas different than your own. That doesn't make any of us better. What I tell people when they're like, well, how do I get into discussion with someone who I know I don't believe in? And the first thing I said is, find a place of agreement as fast as you can and first, and find it often. We had the great debate around masks in this country, and it evolved over the 2 years after the pandemic in 2020, right? But at the beginning, there was very much, should I wear, shouldn't I? I won't, I will. And it was a polarized issue. And the example I give folks is I could be in a discussion. I wore masks during that time, Bay Area, everyone did. And you were seen as crazy if you didn't. And I had the luck of being on this baseball team for my son with folks who felt very differently. It was a team of all Republicans in a different city because we couldn't play baseball in Berkeley. It wasn't allowed. So we traveled so he could keep playing. And when we would discuss masks, I would agree first and foremost, not agree with something I don't believe in, find a place where you do agree. So they said, it's giving my kids pimples and they're feeling bad about themselves. And I said, that sucks. I agree. It gives my kids pimples too. It is gross. Can we just agree to that? It's hard to breathe. I can't exercise when I'm wearing it. Me either. I agree. It does suck. I can't breathe either. But we had people trying to deny that. Oh, it doesn't give pimples. Oh, you can breathe just fine. It's come on, find the place where you agree. So any argument, there are points where you agree. It doesn't mean you agree with the whole thing. The more we do that, the more it allows the other side to do that too. And then you can have a conversation about, well, what is the actual disagreement? It opens up much more possibility when you're not seen as irrational, or because that's like denying reality. No, it doesn't give pimples. It does. We often say, oh, how can we have, at least on my side on the left, there's often, I don't want to talk to people who don't believe the same facts I believe. And I said, well, what are your facts? And people don't just see a fact and then change their mind. We will listen to somebody based on how they make us feel. So if I just hit you over the head with a fact, you're not going to change your mind. If I have a conversation with you and we talk and I listen to where you're coming from and I understand and I relate to the background, the feeling of we're in this together makes it possible to hear facts. And also, we don't always have all the facts right either. It's just the truth. So.
Wow, that's amazing. And I love that you said, find the agreement. You found that common ground, and then you were able to navigate a conversation with someone and continue that relationship. Because they, like we talked about earlier, sometimes the relationship ends because you can't find that common ground or agreement. And when people don't feel seen and heard, that's when the conflict happens or disagreements happen even more. So I love that you really talk about being able to choose common ground. And then I know that one of your keynote speaking is on this topic of the radical act of choosing common ground and making unlikely allies to create change. So can you elaborate a little bit more on like how you utilize this idea of using common ground to make allies to then solve the world's toughest problems, because I think a lot of us are in disagreement or we're trying to compete against each other, especially in the nonprofit world where we're competing for dollars. We're not going to work together, and we need to find that common ground and work together to solve the biggest problems.
Yeah. Well, look, I think we need to understand the simple stuff first, right? That you can have a discussion around masks, or a lot of times I often tell folks, like, you know how to order a pizza with someone. Like, if you eat meat and I'm a vegetarian, you're not going to make me eat a meat pizza. We're going to come up with a way to find some common ground. We will split it in half. We will find a veggie we all like. We will, you know, we'll order two pizzas. There are a million ways to do it. We know how to do it. And we also have those people we love in our life. And I'm lucky to have my dad who raised me, who I love dearly, who is like completely opposite from me politically. Like, he's a diehard Republican. He voted for Trump twice. We definitely want to argue about just about every single issue. Well, I know when we argue, and he loves to talk politics, as do I, probably part of why I love to talk politics, I know in the end we will still love each other. That's really important. So first, like, remembering there is someone in your life who you love, who you disagree with, who you don't have a problem fighting, like loud, screamy fights, and still loving each other after. We all have that example. We also have the example of ordering a pizza. So first, I want to tell people, you got to do the small things right and recognize you know how to do them. You have all the tools you need. They're there. Now, for us at Dream.org, people might say, okay, fine, I can order a pizza, but there's no way to change things in government. It's just too messed up. It's just too difficult. And so that's where Dream.org comes in, is to try to show that, no, it is possible at scale for the toughest problems. And we work on the two problem sets we chose at the time at our inception, which we thought were really hard to get any bipartisan agreement on or make any movement on, was criminal justice reform and climate. Deep, dear to my heart. I come at reforming the criminal justice system from a place of justice and fairness and that little activist kid I always have been. And climate, it's really hard to grow up and it not be one of the biggest issues. Seeing how it got so polarized in our lifetime is bizarre. And so we thought, can we take that model of finding common ground and solving problems, like what pizza are we going to order? Can it apply to the large scale? Because for us, we won't do anything that increases the polarization. I won't compromise on what I want to see. I want to see less people incarcerated, more people rehabilitated while they're there and coming home safely. I am not going to compromise on that no matter what. Take my value of who I'm there for, the people inside. Can I come to the table with people who have different values and make some changes towards my outcome? And the answer we found is yes, big time yes. And in my TED Talk, which I think is what you're referencing, mm-hmm. Radical Act of Common Ground, I go through what I think is one of my lifetime achievements of the First Step Act. It was this federal bill that we started working on during the Obama administration. And when Obama left office, there was a question, can we still work on it during the Trump administration? And it was going to be a piece of legislation of massive criminal justice reform. And a lot of people didn't want us to do that. Oh, you won't get as much in it if you keep working on it, because now they're Republicans' control of everything, or it won't get through, or they'll put poison pills in this bill that we won't want to accept. Forget about it. And what our team did was looked inside and said, well, everyone inside prison doesn't want us to stop working on this. We can't wait 4 years or maybe even 8 years till the politics are better. What can we do now? And so we kept that bipartisan coalition that was there under Obama, but we couldn't get it through. And we continued to build a big, broad table of folks to work on this bill, the First Step Act. And it got passed, not with a little bit of bipartisanship. 89 senators in a divided Republican-controlled Congress voted on this piece of legislation, which 5 years later, 20,000, I think it's now getting closer to 30,000 people have come home from this piece of legislation. And when I say that to people, it blows their minds. But the thing is, it won't get reversed because we did that hard work of bringing people together. And the people at the table weren't there for the same reasons I was. I care about justice. I care about racism. There were red state senators who just don't want taxpayer dollars going to the prison industry. They'd rather it go somewhere else. Fine. You're still at the table. It could be different reasons, but we're going to work on this piece of legislation and get it done. Otherwise, we could have done nothing was the alternative. And so that spirit, that pizza spirit, it can be done at scale. And we've been doing it before that. We're doing it after that. It's possible. And I think it's necessary given the heightened polarization that we're in.
Yeah, definitely. And thank you so much for giving that analogy of the pizza. I love it. And being able to navigate like how there's so many different ways that you can work around a solution to come out with a positive outcome. And I would love to know, and this is just something I'm curious about, because I think a lot of nonprofits don't think that they can get involved with legislation or with activism because there are certain rules around that. So how has Dream.org, or how can other nonprofits, because I think there's only so much change you can do on the ground level, but it really is a systems change. And so how can nonprofits really step up and start to advocate for more systems level change?
Yeah. Well, I think first understand the law between C3 and C4 activists. I don't want to give too much legal advice on what any nonprofit can and can't do, but as a nonprofit, if you are in the social change space, there is a lot that you can do, a lot. Any education efforts, any talking with any of your congresspeople to move forward legislation that you're passionate about, that is well within the right of any nonprofit. You can't endorse a candidate. That's like the clear line. Nothing we do even borders on that. We do also have a C4 that does some of the other work as well. So, but not much. Quite honestly, most of what we do is under the C3 lens, although we do have a C4 for some particular things. What I find moves our legislators the most is stories from people who are directly impacted. And that's something almost every nonprofit has. So when my team brought in to Lindsey Graham, a Republican senator's office, brought in someone who was impacted by the legislation that we were working on, which is the Equal Act, crack and cocaine sentencing disparities, same drug. They were sentenced at 100-to-1 ratio. We've gotten it knocked down, but it should be a 1-to-1 ratio. Brought someone in who spent what feels like a lifetime inside because of this disparity and tells her story. It moved him to get on board and sponsor the legislation. And that piece, I think, is something all of us have. We have the storytellers. When you have a human connection to somebody who's gone through it, it's really hard to turn your back on it. It's really hard not to open up your mind to include other worldviews. And I think that's really important. It's important for us to be open to, for me on the left, to be open to hearing the experiences of people completely different than me too. That's shaped my view. If I were to write a piece of climate legislation from where I sit here in California, it would include electric vehicles and drought and fire and these things that are very important to me in California. But when I sit down with folks on the front line of climate change on a farm in Middle America, they have a whole bunch of different ideas and solutions and concerns. If I couldn't include them, my piece of legislation would be anemic. So the stories that of folks who have different stories to tell is quite important too.
Yeah, I definitely agree. And I love that you're able to, because I noticed in your bio that you said storytellers as part of Dream.org. And I think a lot of nonprofits struggle with storytelling, even though that's our aspiration, is being able to tell stories, but we're serving the most vulnerable populations. So I'd love to know your advice on like how you navigate that fine line of maintaining the dignity and confidentiality and just the humanness of a person without exploiting them for the purpose of getting something passed.
Yeah, absolutely. I think just naming it is the first most important part. Why are you telling this person's story? Or why do you need this person? One, have the person tell their own story. I think that's important. Two, compensate people. We do our lobby days. We fly out the folks that are part of our network so that they are fairly compensated. They're coming, they're doing important work. So I think absolutely that's important. But what are we doing? We are trying to change the world. This is something we all have a stake in. So if I'm working on criminal justice reform and you have been impacted by the criminal justice system, we've got to be in this together. And how can we do that in our different roles and where we're at? We need an understanding of it. It's not exploitative at all if what you're trying to do is you share the same mission and you seek the same change. I think the exploitation comes when you're like, I'm going to use this and it's not your story and it's not your community and it's something else, but it's going to help you fundraise. That's where the exploitation comes in. But having like authentic relationships, and for folks who've been inside prison, it's not just exploitative that comes to mind, which it does. Trust me, we've dealt with that a lot. But it's also the trauma, being re-traumatized constantly by having to tell that story. Mm-hmm. That's real. And it comes full circle to this beginning of the conversation, reading bios out, is one, every single person's story matters. If you are not in a place where you can tell it, do not tell it. But as soon as you can, there is something in your story that's going to connect with someone else out there. I definitely didn't think I had a story to tell until I became CEO and realized I had to start talking about my life. And when I first started talking about it, it was remarkable. All of the things that add up that somebody hears and will come up to me after and say, oh, I'm a first generation kid. That resonated with me. Or I used to be an animal rights activist, whatever. Those pieces people connect with. And in fact, one of our early bipartisan partners on criminal justice reform was Koch, K-O-C-H, which we don't agree on much, especially on green and environment. But on criminal justice reform, the general counsel there, Mark Holden, amazing person who's been our partner on a lot of criminal justice work, he had a relative that went to prison. So he had a direct contact with it. He was passionate about it. But one of the things I discovered about him was that we had one of the same favorite movies, Almost Famous.
It's a good one.
It's a great movie. I know my kids have finally seen it too. It's a great movie. But just knowing that there's something we relate to, I might not have anything else in common, but that kept us in this work together for a long time. And we can find that. We can find that with each other.
Yes, I love that. I love just being able to find the common ground. And Almost Famous is a great movie. And I love that your kids have watched it now. I would love to know, obviously, you're the CEO of an organization. You're passionate about climate change and criminal justice reform. And so how do you balance like being the activist in you and having to lead a team to do the same, to fight the good fight?
Yeah, chickens and chainsaws is what it feels like, juggling all of it at the same time. I just remember that young kid I was that was always passionate about justice, and that at different points in our lives, we all have different roles and different callings. I honestly didn't want the CEO role. I thought it was like the principal of a school. You get like all of the problems and headaches. Everyone blames you for everything. And if you're a good leader, everything that goes right, you give the credit to somebody else. That is a lot of what it's like as a CEO, especially at an organization that's so dedicated to servant leadership. And I'm also an optimist at heart. That is really hard in these times when things are quite dark, to be someone that tends to always see the light, that sees another day will come. And our belief as an organization also happens to coincide with my belief as a human that tomorrow can be better than today. And I believe that. I think my hardest time is balancing when the rest of the team isn't there, when we have to sit in the darkness for a moment. That's been quite a big challenge. But when I say I'm an optimist, I don't think it's out of naivety. I don't think it's that I think, oh, everything's going to be roses and tomorrow sunshine. I believe that if you do the work every single day, if you keep working, you create the future that's going to come. So I'm an optimist because I believe in my ability to do the work and my team's ability to do the work. Just keep doing it. We are the ones that make change. I've just seen too much of life now to see it any other ways. I've worked hard and watched change happen. And so I'm an optimist because I believe in us and our abilities to create that future.
I love that. And I want to talk a little bit more about how you navigate the darkness, because I can only imagine there is a lot of hard times trying to push things forward in legislation, working to get bipartisan agreement and maybe getting pushback and not feeling like you're running against on a treadmill that's not going anywhere, a hamster wheel or whatever analogy you want to use. But how do you navigate? How do you, because I talk a lot about on this podcast, like providing emotional safety and psychological safety and emotional connection, which is allowing people to voice their fears and needs. And so how do you navigate that within your own organization when you do have to sit in those times of darkness? Because I think it is important to not just let them pass, to acknowledge it, and then be able to provide a solution to move forward and continue to create that optimism. So how do you navigate those times of darkness?
I think first is to recognize, you said it first, to acknowledge it and say it and let it be heard. And sometimes I want to sweep it under the rug too fast. And so for me, learning to let it sit and being okay with that folks might stay in darkness longer than me, that's just part of life, right? We all process things differently. But also, there have been darker times. Some of us have seen them. Some of us have heard stories. We know some of them are happening at different parts of the world. There have been darker times and we have gotten through it. You only have to look at this country and think about the history of enslavement and the Jim Crow. And after that, and think about what has been overcome by Black America in this country to feel like, oh, there have been darker times and still people are here and fighting. And that's right here in this country. And it's in the very recent, it's the now, right? Like people persevere. So one, they're darker times. That's always gotten me through, but not everyone's like that. It was like, I was one of those weird people in childbirth. I wanted everyone to tell me how anyone can do this. Everyone's done this. This isn't so hard. So there's a part of me that gets me through versus other people. People want different things. So for me, knowing there's always been darkness and it's been a lot worse and people have come through much worse, that helps me on a day-to-day basis. But Valerie Kaur, I don't know if you're familiar with her book, is See No Stranger, and she runs the Revolutionary Love Project. And she asks this question often. She says, what if this isn't the darkness of the tomb? What if this is the darkness of the womb? And that what we're in right now is this darkness of something waiting to be born. And she uses that analogy to talk a lot about what future is just waiting here in this darkness to be born. And that helps a lot because our experience of darkness, the pain we have, that is exactly what helps us. If you think of any big leap you've made in your life, it usually comes after a crisis. You need to have that dark moment to be able to see clearly about what you want to do next. And so a lot of times that is the question. Our team loves Valerie. Her book is part of all the trainings that we do. But that idea, what is this grief telling me? What is this rage telling me? What lesson does it want me to learn to give birth to that new thing that's about to happen?
Oh, that's so beautiful. We'll link to the book in the show notes and I'm going to add it to my cart because I'm always looking to read and learn from other people that are doing this work. And I would love to know, do you have any other leadership lessons that you've learned along the way as you've really evolved from being a grassroots activist to now leading an organization that is making real change at the system and government level?
One of them that we mentioned before this, when you and I were talking, was this idea of hope it's your fault. And it usually is. And to me, that's a really important lesson, especially in the work I do, is knowing how to say you are wrong. And just like I said, there's always a place to find agreement. I believe there is always a place in any big mistake that happens. There is a place where you had a piece in it. Even if 99% of it was someone else's fault, 1% of it was yours. And being able to acknowledge and recognize that place where you are wrong opens up a whole world of possibility. And so as a leader, often people don't want us to be wrong. We are asked to be right all the time. Folks look to me for leadership and saying, this is where we're going. This is how we're getting there. This is the path I know to be true. In fact, I've learned that I'm a very collaborative leader. I will always be that. But sometimes when I'm too open to persuasion and saying, tell me everything, I want to hear it all before we move, that can cause panic and chaos too. So folks want us to be a bit prescriptive and going ahead. But that is very different than saying I was wrong. Being able to say I was wrong is not the waffling. That is leadership. It is a huge part of leadership to be able to take on the I was wrong and say it very clearly and specifically. There's a piece about, yeah, I was wrong, that thing didn't work. But if we can be really specific about our piece, no matter how small, tiny, or how big, helps everyone else own their piece. And that is necessary to know that you're not going to get fired if you're wrong. You're not going to get disciplined if you're wrong. You're just going to get to solve what went wrong so you can move forward next time. And the best thing about being wrong and it being your fault is you have the power to fix that. And that's a lesson I always tell my kids because it's always everyone else's fault, right? The teacher was terrible. okay, I can't change the teacher, but what can I change? It's the stuff that you did. So,
This is so good. I love that. And I know that a lot of organizations, I talked about this on the podcast episode I recorded earlier this week, is like the most successful people have failed and they acknowledge their mistakes and they have that mindset of moving forward and having that growth mindset from those mistakes. And I love the way that you frame that. Before I ask where people can find you, one of the questions I love asking is, what is lighting you up right now? What are you excited about? And it could be, I know your kid's going off to college, so I don't know if that's an exciting thing, or it could be work, personal, whatever, but what's lighting you up right now?
Yeah, definitely not my son going away, but hopefully next year I'm going to be like, I just can't wait to see who he's going to become. I'm not going to have him listen to this podcast because he will hate that I said that, but I'm very excited to see who he's going to become. I think what's lighting me up right now is, this is going to be super nerdy, but we're trying to seed this entire sector of justice innovation and justice tech. What are the most disruptive ideas that could completely transform the prison system? Because the whole thing is broken. And as much as I love doing the reforms we're doing, because they have real impact on real people, and we will keep doing it, I also think we're ready for a leapfrog moment. And so in October, we are giving away $1 million prize. We have gone through a year-long process of finding those entrepreneurs or those big ideas out there that could completely transform the incarceration industry and actually rehabilitate people, actually bring people home who are better instead of worse. And I'm just really excited about what might be possible in that field, but it's going to require a lot of imagination. I'm excited to see what's in everyone else's brains when you open up that. What if we just did this very differently?
Yeah, you get to provide that platform for people to be creative. And sometimes that's what people need, to really have that spark of innovation. Well, where can people follow along with this project and just you or dream.org?
Well, luckily our name is very easy to find us. Dream.org is our website. So you can find out about dream.org and type in justice innovation if you're interested in that, or justiceinnovation.org will bring you there too. But you'll be able to find any of that on our website.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for this conversation, Nisha. It's been such a pleasure getting to know you more about your work and your background and just the passion that you have for your organization and the mission and the programs that you set out to change.
Thank you.
If you have valued these stories or learned something from what you've heard, please share this podcast episode or follow me on LinkedIn. Thank you so much for your support, and together we can build a better community and world.